Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. My name is Sarah Hopkins.
And I'm Amanda Noga, and these are conversations to elevate your health, relationships, and soul.
Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome back to the Elevate Podcast. Today we've got a beautiful interview for you with Dylan Smith. He is an Ayurvedic practitioner and the founder of Vital Veda, which is an Ayurvedic clinic in Sydney, Australia. And we cover a lot of ground in this episode. Dylan is a super passionate teacher and proponent of Vedic wisdom as a whole. And we break down the foundations of Ayurveda. I know some of you will be super familiar with this and others of you will really appreciate the breakdown that happens. We, of course, had to touch on the current COVID situation that we are in the midst of at the time of recording and how we can use Ayurvedic wisdom to support our immune system and our microbiome. We also get into some deeper, soul-y stuff, talking about Dharma and purpose and how Ayurveda understands that. So there's a lot going on. There's many tangents that we could have gone down the rabbit hole with. Oh, and in the beginning, I asked Dylan to share a little bit about his background and kind of former life. He thought I meant past life, which isn't exactly what I meant, but there's some really cool kind of tidbits that come through in that first part of the interview. So I hope you enjoy this episode. There's some really like golden seeds of wisdom that are kind of scattered throughout. So I hope you enjoy and let's get into the interview. Hi, Dylan. Thank you so much for being with us today on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate all of the work that you do. You've got a beautiful practice on the east coast of Australia. And I guess to kick off the episode, I'd love to know a little bit about how you got into Ayurveda and a bit of background there and maybe what your past life entailed, how you discovered it, how you got into it.
I guess to start more earlier on in terms of my past life, because that came before my current life, I'm not quite sure, really. I'm not that type of person who has insights into their past life. In fact, it's quite rare for people to have an insight into that because it's not really relevant for people. In fact, as soon as the baby comes out the womb and takes its first breath and exposes to oxygen, it immediately forgets all its past lives. And interestingly, right before it comes out of the womb, in I think it's the last, maybe it's a month or so before, or not even a month, right before it comes out, it's inflicted with a heavy memory of all its past lives, and it is weighing up all the good and the bad, and so much is going on through their mind and through their soul, and then as soon as it exits the womb, straight away it forgets it all as kind of a blessing to relieve it of this excess thinking of weighing up good and bad and karma. So I don't remember much, but all I can say is I probably had a close relationship with India, as that's something that I really love and is a part of my life. And I used to live half the year in India, and I've got like my second family who are in India, who are my gurus, my teachers. I enjoy living in India and spending time there very much. It feels like home to me. And yeah, how did I get into this? Essentially, it would be through meditation. I practice a tradition of meditation called Vedic meditation. And the man who kind of brought this Vedic meditation to the world is Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He's a famous seer. Maharishi means great seer. And he's famous for, you know, teaching the Beatles to meditate. And many people would know him. He came in about the 60s and really re-enlivened the Vedas. Even in India, the Vedas were very much suppressed and not known because of the British, especially British invasion and everything. It was not enlivened. So Maharishi really took that and spread it to the West, which inevitably made the East, made India more fascinated. And as soon as the West started to value it, so did then the India started to follow. And so he taught meditation, and that's kind of my tradition where it came from. And of course, the Veda The Veda is the body of knowledge which governs the laws of nature. So it's a very fundamental science. And from that, Ayurveda comes from, and yoga and meditation, and something called Stapachya Veda, which is Vedic architecture, Vedic astrology. So many things come from the Veda. In fact, probably every single thing that people indulge in has its roots in the Veda. Through that tradition, I met my guru. I went to his clinic and for some general Ayurvedic treatment in India. You know, he was very close to Maharishi, so that's kind of the connection. Meditation came first, and then deeper, I wanted to explore the Ayurveda. And I was just really inspired by the clinic and all the magnificent healings that were occurring in India. So I decided to, he just suggested, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was just wanted to get out of studying architecture at university, didn't know what to do. And he's just like, come study Ayurveda with us. Don't study anywhere else. Just come here and we will teach you. And that's how it started.
Beautiful. So the entry point for most people is to Ayurveda is through the doshas. So we were wondering if you could give us a brief rundown of what each dosha type is for those that may be unfamiliar with it.
Okay. Yeah, it's the entry point, but it's actually quite an advanced topic. And I actually don't usually like to speak about the doshas much. But in the Vedas, it says that the universe is comprised of five elements: space, air, fire, water, earth. Everything in the universe has these elements, every human, every plant, every herb, every object. And the science of Ayurveda is about balancing, you know, bringing balance into that object or person or substance, a balance of these elements. Doesn't mean they're in equilibrium state, but it means balancing them according to their nature, how they should be. And Ayurveda made it even more simple, said, forget five, let's make it into three. And they created the three doshas. So Vata is air and space, Pitta is fire and water, and Kapha is earth and water. And they're really just, I guess, a simplified way. It kind of makes treating more perhaps effortless and more foundational. It's really the foundation and the root of health of these five elements. Everything can be traced back to five elements. You know, we can get so specific and try to, you know, manipulate a hormonal system or a certain metabolic pathway or certain chemical or certain constituent, mineral, whatever. But really, if we just go down, these are all kind of relative expressions of their root, which is more at the deeper layer before they get to that manifested state. They are bubble up and the elements are really their foundation. So by treating at the elemental level, or by treating at the doshas, that's more the root. And then it will take care of everything else, that the huge dynamic array of manifestations that arise from the doshas. So one thing I'd like to say is people get really caught up about doshas. You know, they say, oh, I'm Vata, I'm only going to do Vata things or eat Vata things. But the reality is your dosha, that is your elemental makeup or your doshic makeup, that always changes. It changes with the time of season, changes with what's going on in your life. If you're a woman, when you menstruate, it changes. When you ovulate, it changes. Maybe you just flew to Bali. Maybe you just lost your job. Maybe you just broke up. You know, you ended a relationship. Something stressful happened. It's always changing. And I find a common trend, you can call the modern Ayurveda and how it's becoming fashionable, is this doshic, you know, really recognizing doshas and attaching to that, because we should be adaptable to our current state. We need to be more in tune with what's readily available and what's our current state. And even Ayurveda says primarily eat and act and do your regime according to the season. Then secondarily, if there's a real doshic imbalance that is always there and we need to consider, then you can always consider that. So for example, if say Vata, okay, it's air and space element. And we can go through them, but it is a bit advanced. But Vata, because it's the foundation of Ayurvedic anatomy and physiology. Vata is air and space. A common qualities of Vata is dry, light, cold, mobile, rough. So, and sukshma means subtle. So it's very dry, means that's the air and space element, light. So there's going to be like dry bowels, dry skin, you know, more prone to constipation, dry brain, which means lack of neurotransmitter communication. So that can lead to neurodegeneration in the brain, like Parkinson's, dementia, Alzheimer's. You know, vata in the brain is really what happens at the old age. Very common. This epidemic of Alzheimer's and dementia is really because of essentially dry brain, or we can call vata in the brain. So to deal with that, we need to lubricate the brain specifically, but the whole body as well. And so if someone did have a strong vata imbalance all the time, for example, maybe they had a lot of dryness, they had a lot of air in their body, in their joints, they constantly click their joints and there's too much air, which is, you know, causing some blockage there and some arthritis. Then while, you know, adjusting primarily to the season and what's going on in your life, then you can always consider the vata. Always keep an eye on the vata. And the way to do that is maintain regularity all the time, because vata needs routine, regularity. Maintain lubrication, making sure you're lubricating well, giving yourself an oil massage, internally eating the good fats like ghee, sniffing oil up the nose to lubricate the brain, not eating dry foods, you know, not eating raw foods, always having some good quality oils in your foods, not exposing yourself to the wind and especially the ears where the vata enters, where the air element enters into the body. So just these things, this is what I mean by kind of secondarily considering the dosha if it's something that needs to be really attended to. And I'll give one more example with the pitta. And if you want, we can go through the kapha. But the pitta is mainly the fire element. So if someone had, and the qualities of pitta is sharp, they're very, you know, sharp, zealous, and they're hot. So, you know, they can tend to really overheat, whether it's in the intestines, can become highly inflamed and manifest as, you know, irritable bowel syndrome or gastric ulcers, or can be skin conditions like eczema, psoriasis, dermatitis. And then again, in the stomach, like hyperacidity, heartburn, hiatus hernia, any of these things, if that is kind of an underlying imbalance, then definitely, even in the winter, when we can have more of the heating things, and we still always have to consider the pitta if they have that condition. So then, okay, although it's winter and nature's providing naturally what heats the body, I still need to, you know, be careful, don't have too much of the spicy things, and don't get indulged too much in the kind of activities that make you heated.
Yeah, I completely agree. I often say to students, like, one of the biggest roadblocks, I think, is over-identifying with one dosha or another. And like you said, thinking that we should only do that thing and we're only vata or we're only pitta. Of course, we are all of the elements, we're all of the doshas. But yeah, it's such a rich topic. Maybe we should touch on kapha just for fairness.
We don't want to leave kapha out. So kapha is the earth and water element. So it's responsible for all the structure in the body and the fluids in the body. And the gunas, the qualities of kapha is guru, so heavy, manda, slow, hima, cold, snigda, oily, guru manda, hima, snigda, slakshana, stable, greasy. These are the qualities of kapha. So, you know, it can have excess lubrication, excess heaviness. So whether it's heavy limbs, heavy emotions, feeling low, feeling slow, lazy, lethargic. But then in a balanced state, that can be really stable. They say kapha is more rare. Vata is the most common, then pitta, and then kapha is the most rare. And kapha have a blessing of the stability of their mind and their body, and they're typically stronger immunity. And, you know, while someone can come and tell you your health is at jeopardy, you know, the vata person might, because of their instability in the air and space element, which is kind of leaving them airy-fairy and ungrounded, they can react to that fear more easily and develop fear. But the kapha is so grounded and their mind is well lubricated. So it's, you know, it takes things slow and it doesn't react quickly. It slowly can metabolize what's going on and they just kind of smile at everything which is going on, all the stresses. So it's a blessing. And again, if kapha is in an imbalanced state, you know, if there is too much heaviness, whether it's overweight or excess water, you know, whether it's the water channels are filled, diabetes type 2 is a typical, you know, can be related very much with the kapha, because you've got excess water, not just the water, but the water element in like a blood glucose, so like a sugary toxic fluids in your body, which is causing strain on the kidneys and pancreas. Then you always got to consider the kapha. So, you know, you really don't want to have the excess heavy foods, because, you know, you need things to lighten. you want to avoid cheese and yogurt and meat, especially at dinner time, and sweets, heavy foods, and focus on the lightening things. The stimulation is very good for kapha. So, you know, get out and get sunlight and move the body, do exercise, and really get into routine, and don't let the inertia develop. There's so much more to say about the doshas, but that's a brief summary.
Yeah. Something I love about Ayurveda is the understanding that health is infinite and we have the capacity to kind of tap into that resource that, yeah, like I said, is infinite. If you could elaborate a little bit on your understanding about, you know, the standards of health that we currently subscribe to as a culture and why that might be a little bit problematic and not helpful.
Yeah. And before we talk about the standards of health, that's really beautiful what you said, the word infinite, because our health is infinite. And what that means is that we all, every single person, has the memory of perfect health. When you were born, you were pretty much perfectly healthy. Even if you weren't, some babies are born without an organ, but you still have the memory on a cellular level of perfect health. Even someone with deep chronic disease, they've had it for decades, the memory is still there of health. So that's the beauty of Ayurveda, is that the potential is there. The infinite possibility is there. You can re-enliven that memory. That's what Ayurveda does by the diet, the lifestyle, the techniques. It re-enlivens that memory of health. And then when that comes, it's not about getting rid of the disease. It's about enlivening the health. Focus on the health. Mm-hmm. Even the individual can do that themselves. Is stop thinking about your disease and, you know, trying to take, you know, eat according to that and being precautious and talking about it and researching about it. Put your awareness on your health, then that will grow. That's what we want to grow. And then the disease, the imbalances will naturally dissipate. So everyone has the potential, everyone has the memory of health. And that's why people can heal from terminal illness. This is what these miraculous quantum healings are. It's just re-enlivening that at a radical state. And that's what the Ayurveda does beautifully. I've been speaking about kind of, I guess, changing and redefining the norms of health, because currently when you look at the statistics of chronic disease and things like, you know, cancer is going to affect one in two men and one in three women, and autoimmune disease is really skyrocketing, especially in Australia, and macular degeneration, premature blindness, infertility is a really big one, especially with the males, a reduction in sperm count, 50% reduction in the past 3 decades, which is nothing. As long as they've been testing for sperm count, a 50% reduction in the last 3 decades. That's huge. And that's a big contribution to infertility. People just put all the blame on the women, but the man is half as important. Yeah, there's a whole lot. Neurodegeneration is huge. You know, Alzheimer's, dementia, it's now becoming normal for your grandmother or your mother to go into the old age home or lose her hearing or lose her memory. You know, oh, that's just her age. No, this is the thing we have to change, is it's not her age. That's separate. That's a neurodegenerative condition. According to Ayurveda, you should live to 120 years old and thrive. And people, when I say that, they're like, oh, I don't want to live to 100. I don't want to. But because they're associating aging with disease. Ayurveda says your senses should be fully functional till you're about 100. And your cognitive function right now, Sarah and Amanda, all our cognitive function should be the same as it is when we're 190 years old. That's the truth. And there are people like that. I'm sure you've met one or two or few. And then it's inspiring. And that's natural health. But unfortunately, it's not becoming the norm. So we need to, you know, I invite everyone listening to choose to be part of that, what's becoming a minority of natural health, and take ownership and confidence in obtaining that. Because if you think if you're expecting to lose your hearing at 80 years old and to start losing your memory at 70 years old or whatever it is, that's what's going to happen. But when you have the knowledge eliminates fear. So when you have the knowledge, and knowledge means perception of the reality of health, then you can thrive till you're 120 years old.
Beautiful. Pivoting a little bit, can you comment on the role of Ayurveda in the context of the immune system?
Yeah, well, an aim of Ayurveda is to make the body heal itself. So we don't want to, you know, give some, this is the big difference between even Ayurveda and some natural therapies, whether it's, you know, nutraceuticals or natural supplements or vitamins and all these things is, you know, that's with the herbology versus the nutraceuticals. And that's, for example, if someone has, let's just say low vitamin D, right? Which is very important for immunity. You know, you can take a synthetic vitamin D capsule, but that's not really fixing the problem. The problem is that maybe your skin's has a disability to absorb vitamin D. You know, I wrote an article once, it's called Why Are Sunbathers Still Low in Vitamin D? It's because their skin's physiology is impaired and they're not able to absorb the vitamin D. So sure, you can take a vitamin D supplement, but it's not fixing the issue. Rather go to the root and do some therapy to the skin, which increases the skin physiology so that you can absorb. Or if you're low in iron, you can take an iron supplement, but Ayurveda would give herbs, which triggers your body's ability to absorb the iron from food and also secrete its own iron. So it's getting the body to the job. The same with the immune system. We want to trigger the immune system so it can deal with anything. With all diseases, essentially, is it's getting the body to do the job rather than, you know, trying to give an antiviral medication or try to keep something out of you. And all these viruses and microbiome and bacteria, they're all a part of us and they're inevitably going to be there. It's not about, we need to lose this war mentality that this virus is a terrorist that's out to get us. It's part of us and it's part of the microbiome of Earth at the moment. And this coronavirus just happens to be a novel virus, which means it's new. That's why, you know, it's problematic. But, you know, we just need to welcome that when novel viruses don't come often. When we have good immunity, we can welcome that well. You know, it's not going to cause havoc on us. It's designed, nature has designed it to come into our microbiome, into our body's microbiome. And when you have good immunity, you can welcome it and not allow it to become virulent. Because virus, we all have viruses and we all have parasites and we all have bacteria. The state of your immune system and moreover your microbiome, which is like all the microorganisms that make up your body, which is really more microbes than human in every human. So then that virus or that pathogen or that, sorry, that virus or that parasite does not become virulent. It does not become pathogenic. And that's by having a good immune system, by having a good microbiome and a good body, essentially. It's about the environment and the immune system is an integral part of that.
And we'll link to the podcast episode that you did on the coronavirus as well, because we both enjoyed that. So we'll pop a link to that. That was helpful.
Yeah, and there's another one coming out as well.
Amazing.
Next week.
Mm. Awesome. One of my Ayurveda teachers in India once said kind of a line to me that really stuck. And she said that the whole point of having our health is so that we can live our dharma, so that we can live our purpose. And I wonder if you have any perspective on how Ayurveda relates to, yeah, our dharma, our purpose, maybe how the doshas relate to that or not at all. What do you think?
Yeah, dharma, which means what is the most evolutionary thing you can be doing right now? So it's people kind of mistake it to think it's career or something, but actually it's always changing. Like for you, sorry, is Sarah pregnant?
Amanda.
Amanda, that's right. So for Amanda, your dharma right now is to rest, okay? Rest as much as possible. You know, when my friend just learned recently, became a meditation teacher. She did 3 months of teacher training and really intense and she was just so ready to get out in the world and take over the world and implement a lot of marketing and spread meditation and teach as many people as she can. But she accidentally got pregnant and all those plans changed. Her dharma was not to go and teach meditation. It was to go and rest and cultivate a future human being. So, you know, rest is also, you know, it's like pulling back the bow. We need to honor that before we can go into action. So it's always changing. It's what is the most evolutionary thing you can be doing right now. And it's also a desire for human. You know, there's kind of four main desires according to the Vedas for a human, and that's dharma. So we have this desire to want to serve and perform the most evolutionary thing we can be doing. And we have also a dharma for wealth, which is important as well, because wealth means abundance, resources. We need these in order to live healthily, and also to, you know, we deserve the best. So we should be abundant in wealth. The other is karma. So karma is different. So pleasures in life, that's karma with an out, K-A-M-A. Enjoy the pleasures, enjoy relationships. And the fourth is moksha, which is liberation, enlightenment. That's the ultimate. But dharma itself is a desire, and I'm sure many people feel it. And I'm sure many of your listeners, you know, the more you kind of become conscious, you realize, okay, I want to be worthy. How can I best serve? And the way to figure out your dharma or align with it would be a better word to say it, because we shouldn't try to figure it out. Let it come to you. And the way to align with it is two things. Find something you're good at, because I guarantee you there's something that you're good at and that's so unique to you that no one else can do like you can do. Whether it's, you know, you can still do something similar, but the way you do it, it's completely unique to you. And couple that with how you can serve the world, how you can serve others. And don't think about the world. You don't have to serve the whole world. It starts with your community, with your people close to you. And then that has a ripple effect. That is, you know, kind of the formula to dharma. And for that, of course, you need to be healthy. You know, even myself, I sometimes go to Melbourne to treat, and I do like a week or less, 5 days, 7 days of intense, like I'm working 12-hour days. And recently when I went, I my body copped it. And I called my guru, and I said, Krishnaji, how can this be happening? I'm serving others. I'm doing dharma. But my body, it gives in. But, you know, he's just like, you know, the body has limits as well. And definitely we should be able to perform at high capacity and do the work and do what we have to do. But we also have to consider the body and make that fit so that it can perform dharma. And that's the capacity to perform dharma. And then for those who kind of want to align with their dharma and live their dharma at that time, when you have healthy body and more importantly, healthy mind and clear clarity of mind and state of being, when you're familiar with your true state of being, your true essence, which is really health, it's the fundamental of health, then, you know, you'll align with nature's desires, because your dharma is not your individual desire. You are not an authorship of any of your desires. It's all nature. Nature is the authorship of your desires. You're just an instrument to carry it out. And when you're aligned, which is true health, when you're aligned with your true nature, you know, which is primarily and most easily done through spiritual and then through the mind and then through the body. You've got to do them all. We can't just do the spiritual work and the mind work and have a poor body. We need to all have that aligned in homeostasis, in balance. Then you'll naturally, it'll be more clearer to you, the dharma, and it should just come. It shouldn't be something hard to figure out. So align with health, align with being, and then naturally the dharma will come.
This is a question that I've sort of contemplated, and I think I've heard other people talk about it as well. But do you think that there is, or that we are operating collectively within one dosha currently, in the past? Is there sort of a collective doshic, I don't know if that's even a word, energy, and also dharmic? And if so, can you comment on that?
Yeah, these are really interesting points. Actually, there's definitely collective dharmic, but let's start with collective doshic. I never really thought of it until my friend with this coronavirus spoke to me, and she said, Dylan, do you think, and we've always known, so there has been, I did think about it before, but she said, Dylan, do you think we've been in such a hypervada state, hypervada society? I said, yes, definitely. That's without a doubt. You know, when you look at vata is movement, right? It's nervous system. Everything is moving, hyperactivity. That's vata. And that's what our life is. That's what modern Western life is. You know, working 9 to 5, moving, flying around is extreme vata, because vata is movement, and flying is a radical form of movement, and it's highly vata aggravating. Dryness is the number one quality of vata, and we are very dry. You know, chronically we are dehydrated. Most people are dehydrated, and you're not going to get hydrated by drinking water. You know, we are not hydrated on an intracellular level. Why is the dryness so strong? First of all, because our environment is dry, we have air conditioning, we have screens which dry out the retina, we have electromagnetic fields which dry out the cells, and then we have poor electrical charge for the ability to move the water from our body into the blood, but then more importantly, from the blood into the cells. Intracellular hydration, we don't have that connectivity, that transportation process. So that's leaving us dehydrated. So for so many reasons, we are definitely living in a Vata Saya. And she goes, do you think this whole coronavirus is kind of like pacifying the Vata and increasing the Kapha? Because Vata and Kapha are opposite. Remember, Vata is light, Kapha is heavy. Vata is dry, Kapha is oily. Vata is fast, Kapha is slow. They're both cold. That's the only similarity, but they're real opposites. And when you're treating as a practitioner, when you need to consider that, because when you reduce one, the other one will go up. So I said, yeah, that's fascinating. My name was Anne. I said, yeah, Anne, that's so true, because this virus has just really slowed us down. You know, we were in such a hypervitic state. And as I said, Vata is the most common. So most common people will have Vata imbalance. You'll most commonly see that. They say about there's 80 Vata, 40 Pitta, and 20 Kapha. So by far, Vata is the most. And this coronavirus has just slowed us down. And it said, okay, stop, you know, slow down, kick your feet up, stop traveling and stop moving so much. And it's completely helped with many, definitely reduced the Vata, of course. And then we did this talk about how to kind of deal with a potential Kapha imbalance, because the Kapha increases. What's Kapha? It's darkness, it's slowness, lethargy. People, I've heard so many people report that they're more feeling more tired these days with this lockdown. You know, they're sleeping more and fatigue. They're just getting a chance to shed fatigue, and they're finally body's like, thank you, finally giving me some proper rest. So it's kind of making that happen. But again, they can feel low. And again, we know that depression is increasing with this lockdown. I think there was a suicide, the first confirmed suicide from lockdown in Victoria, I think, a few days ago. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's definitely doshas can be prominent in the collective, and it depends where you are and where, you know, if you're in the workforce, the Sydney CBD or the Melbourne CBD or whatever it is, definitely the Vata is higher. But if you're in the Indian Himalayan mountains in a little ashram, everything is pretty shanti, as they say. And and then with this virus, talk about Dharma, I think there's going to be a massive change in Dharma, because you can say still Dharma is quite an individual thing, but it's definitely collective as well. So I think one of the big changes with this pandemic is a change in Dharma on an individual level. Let's start with the individual level. A lot of people are going to be reassessing, okay, is this 9-to-5 thing really what I should be doing? Am I really want to be, you know, going to working for to have a digital number in my bank account? Really assessing what is, because I think people are, you know, I'm loving reduction in work. You know, there's some aspects of my work has increased a lot because I've been dispensing a lot of medicines. But thankfully, I've got other people to do that. And I've been seeing less patients because I haven't been traveling and people haven't been traveling to me. So I'm loving it. And I'm sure I know many other people are loving the break. Of course, people are also suffering. They're not able to work and make money. But yeah, it's really, really making people question and realize Dharma as well, and kind of get rid of the superficial layer of this is what I should be doing, you know, going to work and working like this. And then that starts on the individual level. You know, whenever we look at something in the collective, it starts in the individual. So the more individuals align to a certain value, then it changes in the collective. So the same will happen in the collective.
Even like anecdotally, I know so many friends and students that are, yeah, for the first time taking a moment to reflect and reassess and do away with the things that aren't really working. And I think there are going to be a lot of silver linings and blessings that come from this global retreat that we're all on.
Without a doubt. You know, as dark as it may seem, and I was also feeling dark about it in terms, I was digging into the rabbit hole of the truth behind the whole situation, the planned endemic, as people are calling it now, and it got dark. And I'm like, geez, man, there's some real evil in the world. You know, trying to control things. But the reality is, no way. It's going to be radical evolutionary change, and we have to embrace that and also shine ourselves and steer the way we want it to steer. We now have power. You know, we need to step into our power. So you need to gain that power, right? People need to gain power in order to be able to use it. And to gain power, well, that's, you know, firstly, you got to eliminate the fear, because when you're fearful, you don't have any power. And knowledge eliminates fear, knowledge of the Vedas, knowledge of perception. And then all the things I talk about, and then I'm sure you guys talk about, the yoga, the Ayurveda, gain power and you can create.
Yeah, it's a real opportunity. I know that everything in Ayurveda is individualized, but I'd love to know if you're willing to share your personal practices, self-care kind of practices, morning routine, anything that kind of comes to mind in that regard.
You want my personal or what I recommend? They're both similar.
Yeah, either or.
You can give us both. I think they'd both be helpful.
Well, the routine is very important, and especially for the Vata dosha. It's definitely for everyone, but Vata is irregular, right? It's unstable. It's earth and space element. They're up in the clouds. And what happens then? Irregularity of thoughts, irregularity of emotions, irregularity of bowel motions, of elimination, irregularity of hunger, irregularity of secretion of digestive enzymes. So the best way to balance Vata is one word, regularity. And what's fantastic for regularity? Routine, especially morning routine. The first thing, according to Ayurveda, in the morning routine is get up before sunrise. And you know, these doshas are also dominant at times of the day. So the Vata time is between about 2 and 6 a.m., just before sunrise. If we get up with that Vata time, that's the air and space element, we capture those qualities of Vata. And what's the qualities of Vata? Creativity, clarity, lightness of being. So when we get up before sunrise, that sticks with us throughout the day. Whether if we get up after sunrise, which is then the kapha time, which is between 6 and 10 a.m. What's kapha? Heaviness, sluggishness, earth element. And you all know from experience, you get up later, even though you're in the bed for longer resting, you're going to feel more sluggish that day. You know, you get up early before sunrise, you feel so energetic. And that's because you're capturing the Vata qualities that are dominant in the atmosphere. So that's really the first thing. And that's the first thing that Ayurveda says when they talk about the daily routine is get up before the sunrise. And in order to do that, by the way, you have to go to bed before 10 p.m. Because again, in the p.m., the doshas are the same. 6 till 10 p.m. is kapha time. That's earth element, heaviness, sluggishness. We want to hitchhike on that kapha, and that will take us throughout the night for good restful sleep. Whether if we go to bed after 10 p.m., which is pitta time, pitta is between 10 and 2, that's fire element, that's metabolism, that's liver detoxifying, that's melatonin secreting. All the repair and rejuvenative mechanisms are occurring. Micronutrients are being absorbed in the body. If we're not asleep during that time, during the pitta time, between 10 and 2, we miss all those vital functions. So it's not about how long you sleep for, it's about when you sleep. And that is the key. You know, sleep is one of the three pillars of health, according to Ayurveda. It's food, sleep, and routine. If we can't get sleep right, if no one is getting sleep right, it's your main biorhythm. How are you going to, you cannot expect to heal other things. You can maybe reduce the symptoms. But whatever it is, if it's a endometriosis, menstrual issue, skin issue, headaches, joint issue, whatever it is, if you're not getting sleep right, you cannot heal that fully. And sleep means good sleep, free of electromagnetic fields and radiation, free of artificial lights, a dark room, peaceful sleeping environment, sleeping at the proper time. And again, the norm of health, talking about the norms of health. When you go to sleep, you should fall asleep straight away and not wake up once, not even to go to the toilet. And when you get up in the morning, you basically jump out of bed. That is natural sleep health. That is health of sleep. But now it's becoming the norm for people to get up 2-3 times to go to the toilet. Sleep is the key, and that's, you know, your fundamental circadian rhythm. So that's one important one. Then once you're waked up, you know, as soon as you get up, brush your teeth and scrape your tongue. When you sleep, you detoxify. Naturally, that's what happens, as I said, in the pitta time. And one of the elimination channels that the toxins will come to is the tongue. So if you look at your tongue in the morning, you'll see a coating. maybe it's white, maybe it's yellowish. If it's black or purple, you need it, you know, email me for a consultation and we can sort that out. But this is what happens in the morning. And for those listening and you've never done it before, look, you do this and let Sarah and Amanda know and let me know what you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't know about this. As everyone's reaction, somehow, I don't know how, the West didn't get the practice of scraping the tongue.
Get the memo.
Yeah, the memo. How they lost the memo, because it's when people do it, you know, when I do lectures, I do a survey in the audience and I ask who scrapes their tongue, and most, you know, maybe I don't know, a fraction will put their hands up. And then I say, for those who scrape their tongue, if you had a choice whether you could brush your teeth or scrape the tongue, if it was scrape your tongue, keep your hand up. And most of them keep their hand up.
Yes.
Yeah. You, what about you two?
Yeah, 100%. I feel like dirty in the mouth when I wake up until my tongue is scraped.
Yeah. First day of all my yoga retreats, I hand out copper tongue scrapers to all of the students.
Awesome. And yeah, copper's the best because it's antimicrobial and antibacterial. And like you said, you know, you hold it in the mouth in the morning. That's great. That means you're conscious, you're aware of it. That's why, you know, it's something so bluntly that people become aware of. And I say the people who aren't, you know, who choose the brush their teeth option, that's probably because they're waiting after 3 minutes of waking up, because you got to do it within the first 3 minutes of waking up. After then, it reabsorbs back into the body, into the gut and the respiratory system. So do it straight away. And then you can sip hot water in order to have bowel motion. You know, this is another norm and natural thing. We should be having a bowel motion every single day in the morning and before we eat anything and before we drink coffee. And again, this is something that is kind of deviating from the norm. And even that, you know, Western medicine says it's constipation's only 3 times a week, but 4 times a week, that's fine. That's classified healthy. It definitely should change. And when people see me, I work a lot with digestive issues, that definitely in most cases changes. And it's very important to eliminate the wastes. So that's, you know, early on. And that can be done anytime throughout the daily routine, as long as it's before the eating or coffee. And yeah, and there I just add a, you know, meditation is an absolutely essential, and I don't think I have to talk about it much because you guys talk about it, and it's just really essential. It's probably the most easiest and effective way to improve your health, because it's connecting you to your true nature, and that's where perfect health lies. Like, that's the easiest way to activate that perfect health, by familiarizing yourself with true being, with your absolute, pure, unbounded state of consciousness, because that there's no disease there. There's no suffering there. Doesn't mean your body's going to change. You know, we're never going to have perfect body. We're never going to have perfect health. We're never going to have perfect skin. We're never going to have perfect digestion. But if your consciousness state is at a state where it's more identifies with being, or capital S self, or absolute consciousness, then what's a, you know, little piece of flesh on a little blue ball going around a little sun in a little galaxy? What's a pinched nerve in the lower back going to do? Or what's some pimples on the face going to do? You are the universe, you know. So this is the importance of meditation, because you actually experience that. Like, maybe many listeners and many people that I speak to, they know that intellectually, you know, I am the universe, we are all part of the one thing. But how much do you experience it in your waking state, in every moment of time? We want to be experiencing it all the time, then nothing can make or break you. So meditation, absolutely essential. And I'll add a few more things. One is self-massage. Have you guys ever spoken about self-massage?
Ad nauseam.
Every day. Every
single episode.
Oh, fantastic. Well, then I don't have to talk much about it. All I'll say is that, again, it's one of the best things for Vata, because your skin has more nerve endings than anything. And it's fantastic to pacify the nervous system. People who do it definitely will feel the difference in their mood. There, if they have anxiety, that will help a lot. And if they have insomnia, that will help a lot for any sleep issues. So it strengthens your nervous system. And how important for a time like today, for your immunity, the first stage of an infection or a virus is called peripheral energetic stage, where it's on the outside trying to get in. And what is your barrier from it trying to get in? It's your skin primarily, your skin and your nostrils. The way to fortify your shield of armor for skin is Abhyanga, self-massage. And so many benefits: nervous system, blood circulation, lymphatic circulation.
The list goes on and on.
Yeah. And it's, again, you just, every day without a doubt, you should be doing it. And even if it's a short version, if you don't have time, just quickly apply it. Of course, not if you are sick or menstruating or any other contraindications. But really, it should be an everyday. It should be like a shower. You know, we bath every day. We also have to lubricate our body and feed the microbiome that lives on our skin. So that's really essential. And then I'd say the last one I'd like to say, which kind of, you know, seems a bit radical, but I think it's so, so, so important right now, is sniffing oil up the nose. And in Ayurveda, it's a daily routine called nasya. And, it, you know, taking ideally a medicated oil. Otherwise, you can use cold-pressed sesame oil, but better to use the higher quality oils and sniff it up the nose. That's just regularly throughout the day, anytime, you know, while you're working, while you're in the car, especially while you're doing it before you do exercise, it's beautiful. Then you breathe it in, or before yoga, and while you're at the desk every couple hours, especially while you're on an airplane. And that's the way to lubricate the brain. You know, the nose is the gateway to the skull, and it lubricates the brain. It activates the sensory organs. It strengthens the sensory organs, prevent the brain from degenerating. And it also activates the pituitary and pineal gland, which is, you know, what we call the third eye, and also the pituitary gland as well, which secretes the hormones. So for people with underactive thyroid, which is quite common, and any hormonal issue, female hormones, sex hormones, adrenal issues, sniffing oil up the nose activates the pituitary gland, which helps secrete these hormones. So that's a really great practice people should start getting more into.
Is there a device, like obviously there's neti pots and things for flushing with water. Is there a device that facilitates the oil sniffing?
I just use a dropper bottle. A dropper bottle of oil. You know, that's what I, on my website, we give the medicated oils, and it's in a small 15 milliliter bottle, and you just pop it in your mouth, in your nostril.
In your nose.
If it's too strong, sometimes we also have a special, what we call special nasica. So it's a stronger version for people with kind of more degenerative conditions or thyroid issues. For that, if it's too strong to put straight in your nostril, just put a drop on your finger and stick your finger up the nose and just sniff it up. It's awesome, and people look at you very interested, and I love getting people's looks.
That's awesome. No, that's one I'm sure you've heard of it, Mandy, but that's one I haven't heard of, and I'm keen to integrate that into all of my other routines. Thank you. As a resource for those that do want to go deeper on this topic, and obviously we'll share all of your links and resources when we conclude, but is there any other resources that you would recommend for people to dip their toes further into the water in relation to Ayurveda?
I'd say the first thing is to familiarize yourself with the Veda, with the source of Ayurveda. And that is, you know, familiarizing yourself with being and your true self, because all knowledge is structured in consciousness. And when you can be more familiar with your true state, then you can learn these things, and you'll grasp them much more effectively. And essentially you'll be able to cognize them, but that might take a lot of inner work to happen. But so, you know, really make, you know, meditation a twice a day non-negotiable practice, and practice these routines. If you want to know more like about these routines that I mentioned, you know, on my website, I've got a free poster which teaches you how to do the self-massage, and also videos on sniffing the oil up the nose. Not that it's hard. You know, articles about tongue scraping and more about the daily routine. But for those who want to learn more about Ayurveda, I get asked it a lot, because a lot of people want to study Ayurveda, and it's pretty hard because a lot of the Ayurvedic knowledge has been misunderstood and confused and misinterpreted. So I just give a word of caution when, you know, when doing research on the internet, things like that, you know, just you want to stick to authentic sources. So I like to, you know, I like to look at the classical texts if you're into that. But for a good starter, I'd recommend the book Perfect Health by Deepak Chopra. And the only thing I'd say about it is ignore the doshic quiz, because I don't like doshic quizzes for the reason we spoke about earlier.
I feel like there's 1,000 doshic quizzes online that seem a little bit superficial.
Yeah. And it's just, again, it's hard to determine what's changing and not. So yeah, that, and, you know, I've got a website of articles and a podcast, and there's also a wonderful website called lifespa.com. Dr. John Dulliard, he's also a disciple of my teacher, who's, you know, much, much older than me. You know, he's been doing it for decades, and he's got a huge library of knowledge of articles and podcasts and videos. Yeah, I mean, I've run occasional online courses, and these are some things I can see. If the, I teach with a school as well in Sydney if people want to go deep. But unless you're going to, you know, look at the classical text, I mean, for those who really want to, I suggest the classical text, but that's a minority of people usually.
Yeah, that will colour for you people. No, I agree. I totally agree as well. I've been lucky to be studying with a teacher in Kerala for the last 6 or 7 years in just very kind of, I guess, apprentice style. And people are always asking me, like, what course can I do? And, you know, this and that. But I don't even know how to put it into words. It's such a different experience learning and learning on an experiential level and playing with it in your own life and really embodying the practices is the best way to learn, I think.
Totally. And it is, I get asked it so much and I find it challenging to answer because I've just seen too much bullshit on the internet and going around. And most of it, you know, some of it's fine. You're just not learning, I guess, the optimal effective recommendations. But sometimes, and when you start getting more advanced and more with the treatments and the therapies, then it can start becoming damaging. So go to either the classical text or to someone who has, you know, I'm lucky to have my teachers who are a line of doctors who have been healing for many generations there, and they have the unbroken lineage of knowledge because so much of the knowledge has been lost. So to find, you know, someone who has a lineage or and just question, you know, if you're going to be reading internet and even if it's a book by an Indian doctor, you know, doesn't mean it's authentic. So just, I guess, you know, question and yeah.
Be discerning.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap it up, I know that your website is an amazing resource. Maybe you could rattle off where people can find more information about all of the things that you offer.
Yeah, so the website's vitalveda.com.au. The podcast is what I love, and I'm allowed to say I love it because it's not my podcast. I interview people, so I think it's freaking awesome. I'm not the main knowledge giver. I interview experts in the field of health and spirituality, and it's just amazing the things that come from that. So that's the Vital Veda podcast. And Instagram is probably where I post the most knowledge regularly, which is Vital Veda. And yeah, then there's the newsletter. You can sign up on the website, which is, I guess, a more detailed, occasional form of giving knowledge as well as updates and offers and events. And then that's about it.
Awesome. For those of us that are not on the East Coast of Australia, do you offer online consultations?
Yeah, I mostly do online, especially now. I've been doing a lot. So yeah, you just email. And in my consultations, the aim is to make you self-sufficient in your health. And again, to trigger your body's ability to heal itself and train that body to do it. That's why, you know, taking the herbs regularly is an important thing. And the herbs I use are very precious. My teachers make them and train your body, get it to do its job itself. And ideally, I don't want to be seeing you for too long. Just get you on the track and then you awaken your memory of health.
I love it, even though I am not an expert like you and Amanda are, but it has so many correlations to the sort of modality that I was taught, which is through the Czech Institute, because it's teaching self-responsibility and sustainability in the context of health, and also looking at the whole person, spiritual, mental, emotional, physical. You know, so it's very, very aligned with everything that I talk about. And I think that's why Amanda and I have been able to be so cohesive in this podcast, even though we're coming from different perspectives, because everything that you're saying is just absolutely in alignment with everything that I love about health and obviously everything that Amanda shares. So thank you so much for your wisdom today and your beautiful calming voice and energy. I'm sure during this time our audience will really appreciate that. And we will definitely share all of the amazing resources, especially yours, that you have shared with us today. So thanks again.
Thank you. And thank you guys for doing all the wonderful work and spreading this. I think this is a really great time for people to be diving into themselves more and developing themselves and their true nature. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Elevate. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed recording it. For any further updates with me, you can come along and follow me at Instagram. I'm at Shopkins Health.
And if you'd like to stay tuned with me throughout the week, I'm at yoga_alchemy on Instagram. And what we would love right now is if you can hit subscribe, leave us some stars, leave us a few words, any questions or feedback, we love to read. So keep it coming and have an amazing day.